This morning, I'd like to learn with you the first Rashi in the Torah. Before we do, I'd like to explain why I chose it for our learning this morning. This coming Shabbos is Shabbos HaChodesh. As I'm sure we're all familiar, there are four Shabboses, Shkalim, Zachor, Parah, and Chodesh, that occur every year. What makes them different, the reason why they have names, is because instead of the Maftir being the last few psukim of the Parsha being read, it's a different Maftir, it's from a different section of the Torah. And then the Haftorah, instead of matching the Parsha, matches the Maftir, and that makes it something special. Rav Zevin, in his Sefer, Moadim B'Halacha, notes that these four Shabboses are actually very old in terms of their origins. If you look in the Mishnah, even though Moshe was the one who, according to the Gemara, set up reading the Torah every Shabbos, the actual dividing of the Torah into the Sedras that we read every week came much later. For any of you who use the classic little blue Tanakh that my students use, and you've ever been confused because it looks like the Perek's on the inside, but then there's another Hebrew letter on the outside, and you can't ever figure out what Perek it is, that's because they're trying to preserve two traditions. The Babylonian tradition was to finish the Torah every year by Simchas Torah, hence we have 54 Sedras or Parshas read every week. The Palestinian, which means something different back then, the Eretz Yisrael tradition was to finish the Torah every 3 years, so that on the seventh year when you got to Hakel and you finished the Torah, it would be part of the whole ceremony. So they had more than 54 parshas or sedras. So if you ever use that classic little black blue Tanakh, I know that last year like five new Tanakhs came out, so since I didn't bring it with me, I'm not being very helpful. In any event, there were a couple of different traditions about what the parshas were. So what the parshas actually became aren't even recorded in the Mishnah. They came so much later. But in the Mishnah, we do have reference to these four Shabboses. They preceded even what the parshas were going to be divided into. That's how important they are, because they come first. Rav Yisaschar Yaakovson, in his two-volume set on the Haftorahs, has a really nice idea about these four Shabboses that I'd like to share with you. We generally think about the fact that Shkalim and Adar and Zachor, excuse me, are for Purim, and Parah and Chodesh are for Pesach. Why? Shkalim is read on the Shabbos either of Rosh Chodesh Adar or before Rosh Chodesh Adar, because we started to collect the Machazit, a shekel, the half shekel at that time. And Zachor is read the Shabbos before Purim because it has to do with Amalek. We always thought of those having to do with Purim. And then Parshas Parah is read the Shabbos before Shabbos HaChodesh, which is about Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And that's because the Parah was supposed to make you pure for the Korban Pesach, and Parshat Chodesh, which was supposed to make Rosh Chodesh Nisan, was supposed to make sure that you celebrated Pesach at the right time. So we had 4 weeks, and primarily, everybody always thought about them as two for Purim and two for Pesach. Rabbi Yaakovson has a really nice idea about how all four of them could actually be considered hachana, preparation, for Pesach. And what he points out is that the message of the Machazit Shekel, that every single person had to give a half a shekel to contribute to the Mikdash for its Korbanot and its Kelim, was... the rules that were set up was that everybody had to give the same amount, and therefore there was an equality amongst the people. Whether you were poor, whether you were rich, you all gave the same amount. And therefore, amongst the nation, there was this idea that everybody was the same and everybody was part of the nation together. Each individual mattered. Rav Hirsch has an idea that that's why it had to be a half a shekel. Each person had to give a half to realize that they're part of a whole, but they never make up the whole themselves. So therefore, Shabbos Shkalim, where you read from Parshas Kitisa and the Maftir, is a message about how as a nation, each individual matters, no matter how much money you have, and each individual makes up part of the whole. Shabbos Zachor, which is when we read about what Amalek did to us, is about us as a nation, as a major unit. It's not necessarily focused on each individual, but how as a political entity, they attacked us as a nation and tried to wipe us out. Then Parshas Parah focuses again on us as an individual, how everyone in the nation needs to be holy, and the Parah Aduma is supposed to make us holy so we can do Korban Pesach. And then Parshat HaChodesh is about how the nation as a whole needs to sanctify the month and needs to make sure that Nisan is set up so that as a nation we can celebrate Pesach in the right time. And what does Pesach celebrate? Our Geula, our creation as a nation. And therefore, all four Parshas, according to Rabbi Yaakovson, lead up to this idea of preparing us for Pesach, where we're supposed to celebrate how we became a nation. And we focus on, alternately, the individual part of the nation and the mass part of the nation. And we alternate between the physical parts of the nation and the spiritual parts of the nation. And therefore, it doesn't exclude the idea that two of them can be for Purim and two of them can be for Pesach. It also includes the idea that maybe as we enter this last Shabbos, Shabbos HaChodesh, we can look at it as a culmination of four special Shabboses that are supposed to prepare us for Pesach, much in line of the idea that you're supposed to start learning 30 days before the halachos of Pesach. So too, you have these four Shabboses before that set you up for Pesach. So I thought that was a really nice idea. Now, this coming Shabbos, Shabbos HaChodesh, the Maftir, is from Shmos Perek Yudbed, Parshas Bo. I'd like to read those psukim with you now, and I'd like to start to discuss the topic of the day. I'm having a hard time finding the source sheet. Ta-da! Okay. Source number one. Vayomer Hashem el Moshe ve'el Aaron ve'eretz Mitzrayim lemor, ha-chodesh hazeh lachem rosh chodeshim. Rishon hu lachem l'chodshei ha-shana. Hashem said to Moshe and to Aaron, saying in the land of Egypt, this month shall be for you the first of the months. The first of it is for you for all the months of the year. Pasakimel, Dabru al Kol Adat Yisrael, go tell the entire nation, a congregation of Israel, Basor lechodesh hazeh, ve'ikvu lehem ish seh levet avot, seh labayit. That on the 10th of this month, each man should take a seh for his house, there should be one seh per house. So basically what happens right away is in the first two psukim, first two verses, we are told that this month, which was Nisan, was going to, from now on, be the first month. This is how the Torah counts. We tend to think of Tishrei as the beginning because of Rosh Hashanah, but whenever you have to count months in the Torah, when it says Chodesh Shlishi or Shvi or whatever, excuse me, they mean from Nisan. So Nisan's going to be the beginning of all the months of the year. And the reason why it was so important to clarify and set apart Nisan as a month was because all the days of Nisan were going to be used for the holidays. On the 10th, you take the animal. On the 14th, you were going to do the korban. So you needed to know when the month began so that you would do the days correctly. The Sforno notices that the word lachem is repeated twice in Pasuk Bet. And he commented on that and said, you know why this is like the first mitzvah that B'nai Israel got on their way out of Egypt? Because as slaves, what was the one thing they never had? Time. And therefore, the first thing Hashem wanted to say to them when they were coming out of Egypt was, this month is for you. This month is for you, the first of the years. Emphasizing the fact that now, time was going to be in their control. And as you notice, when we daven on Chagim, we always say Mikadesh Yisrael, the Hazmanim. As opposed to on Shabbat, when we say Mikadesh Shabbat. God sanctified the Sabbath. We, however, by choosing when the calendar works, thank you, Hillel, we sanctify the months. And therefore it says Mikadesh Yisrael v'Hazmanim, because we're the ones who sanctified when time was. And therefore, as slaves, the most valuable thing that God could give them to express their new status was to give them time. And therefore, that's why the word lachem is repeated twice. Now, what's interesting about this is that in the context of Yitziat Mitzrayim, leaving Egypt, in chapter 7 to 11, we have the 10 Makot. In chapter 12, what basically happens is Moshe gives B'nai Israel the rules for Pesach Mitzrayim. Then he gives them a couple of psukim about how Pesach for Dorot, for generations, will be slightly different. Then it tells us what they did with the Korban Pesach. Then it tells us they left. Okay, so that's what's going on, where these psukim appear. And since we're getting ready for Pesach, as I said at the beginning, this is the maftir for Shabbos HaChodesh. What's interesting for us, and what I'd like to learn with you today, is how this pasuk is the subject of the first Rashi in the Torah. So some of you might be familiar with it. For those of you who aren't, I hope you're going to enjoy. For those of you who are, my goal is today is to learn it, hopefully, on a deeper level. And we always hear Rashi Ruach HaKodesh and Rashi is amazing and Rashi is all this. I hope to show you one of the ways that we can really appreciate the gadlut of what Rashi does. So if you look with me at source number 2, we have the first Rashi in the Torah. Breishit. Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Rabbi Yitzchak said, Lo hayat sarich lahatchil et ha-Torah ela ma'achodesh hazeh lachem. You didn't need to begin the Torah except with Pasuk Bet in Shmos Perek Bet, Ma'achodesh Hazeh Lachem, this is the first month. Shehi mitzvah rishona shenitzdavu b'Yisrael. Because this is the first mitzvah that Israel was commanded. U'matam patach b'Bereishit. So why did you start with Bereishit? Mishum koach masav higid lamo latet lam nachlat goyim. Because of a pasuk in Tehillim that says, the power of his deeds God told his nation so that he could give them the inheritance of the nations. She'im yomru umot ha'olam liYisrael, in case the Gentile nations of the world say to Israel, listim atem, you're thieves, shekvashtem artzot shiv'a goyim, you conquered the lands of the seven nations. Hem omrim lahem, you can respond, kol ha'aret shal ha'kadosh baruch hu, the land belongs to God. Hu bra'a, he created it, unitana la'asher yashar benav, and gave it to whom was pleasing in his eyes. Birtzono nitana lahem, with his desire he gave it to you, and with his will he took it away from you, and gave it to us. This Rashi has been the subject of much discussion, much study. It has puzzled commentators, troubled students for a long time, and I hope that our learning together will give some clarity. I'm sure it's not the only answer out there, but I'd like to share with you what I came out. So the first thing that I want to talk about is Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. That is so unique. For any of us who've studied a few Rashis, even if you haven't studied a bazillion of them, who've studied a few of them, you know that it's very unique for Rashi to quote the name of the person whose idea it is. If you even were to open a Chumash when you got home and looked at like 6 Rashis, you would see that his answer very rarely quotes the name of the person. For those of us who study Rashi very carefully, we therefore try to figure out why he bothered in any particular Rashi to do that. So, for example, I teach the Joseph narratives to my freshmen, and one of the Rashis we come across is in the Yehuda and Tamar story. And Yehuda, after he finds out Tamar is pregnant, before he knows that he's the father, decides that she has to be burned. And all of the commentators want to know why Yehuda chose that. And Rashi says, Rabbi Ephraim Maksha Mishum Rabbi Meir Omer, that Rabbi Ephraim in the name of Rabbi Meir said, because she was the daughter of Shem, and Shem was a Kohen, so she's a Bat Kohen, and the punishment for a Bat Kohen according to Vayikra is that she get burned, so she has to get burned. So, okay, that's fine. A lot of Mefarshim bring that answer. The question is, why does he have to bring the name Rabbi Ephraim Maksha Mishum Rabbi Meir? Why does he have to say that Rabbi Ephraim brought in the name of Rabbi Meir? So the Malbim points out in that case that most of the Mefarshim, when they learn out the halachos in Vayikra about a Bat Kohen who becomes a Zona and therefore disgraces her father and so she has to be burned, it only applies while he's alive. That since it's about embarrassing her father, the only time she gets sreifa is if her father, who she's mechalelet, that she embarrasses, she gets the burning. Rabbi Meir is the only one who says, even if he's dead, that it's still an embarrassment to the father, it's still an embarrassment to his name, even if he's not alive. So since Shem was no longer alive, and most of the opinions would have said that Tamar shouldn't get Sreifa, Rashi Beshita brought the name of the opinion so that you would know that it still works. which gives us such a broad understanding of what goes on in Rashi, that when he brings a name, there's a reason for it. So the question for us is, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, why does he bring a name? If, like the Malbim suggests in Breishit Lamechet, there's a reason there, then maybe there's a reason here. So a popular answer to this question is that he's quoting his father. Rashi is an acronym for Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak. Yitzchak is his father, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak. Therefore, when Rashi opened up his commentary to the Torah, he wanted to give kavod and honor to his father, and therefore he started with his father's name. Now, this idea, from my research at least, can be traced back to the late 1600s, when Rabbi David Halevi, known as the Divrei David, wrote that he saw in an ancient document, a really, really old one, that somebody said that it's Rashi's father. And that Rashi's father wasn't such a learned guy, and Rashi wanted to give him some kind of respect. So he said to his dad, ask me any question, and I'll put it in my parish for you. So his father said to him, so why do you start here? If it's really a book about laws and stuff, why not start with the first law? And therefore Rashi put it as the first comment in order to give respect for his dad. The Divrei David doesn't dispute the fact that it would be Rashi's dad. What he disputes is that Rashi's father wasn't a big Talmud Chacham. In a Gemara in Avodah Zarah, where Rashi comments, he quotes his father as Avi Mori, my father, my teacher. And that there seems to be an inclination that his father was a Talmud Chacham also. So the Divrei David doesn't take issue with the fact that he's quoting his father. He takes issue with the fact that he's quoting his father because he wasn't such a Lamdan. Nevertheless, about 50 years later, a commentary comes out and says, whoever wrote that ancient document should have done his research better, because Rashi's quoting a Tanchuma. And the fact of the matter is, in the last century, we finally located that old Tanchuma. And in fact, if you look at source number 3, the Yalkut Shimoni is quoting that Tanchuma. HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, Lo Haya Tzarich Latchil HaTorah, Elam HaChodesh Hazeh Lachem. And therefore, even though it seems to be a popular answer that Rashi is quoting his father, it seems much more likely that he's quoting the Tanchuma, and that the Tanchuma was said in the name of Rabbi Yitzchak, and Rashi's quoting this Rabbi Yitzchak. Which leaves us with the question, but why? If it's not his dad, then what does this man have to add to our understanding? Because most of the people feel, in the later research of the last couple of years, that it's not really Rashi's father that he's quoting. And if you look at Rashi's comment on the Pasuk in Tehillim, Perek Kuf Yud Aleph 111, verse 6, he says, and in the Tanchuma we see. So we really don't think it's Rashi's father anymore. And for those of you who read Rabbi Etshalom's stuff on the web, he argues another reason that you see that it's not his father is because, just like in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, when he quoted his dad, he said, Avi Mori, why wouldn't he do that here? That's a sign of respect. So we don't really think that it's Rashi's father anymore. And it might just be a case that that ancient document that the Divrei David found just didn't have access to this very old Tanchuma when they said their answer. So our question, which I'm not going to answer now, is, so what does saying Rabbi Yitzchak's name contribute to anything? Okay, put that, store that to the side. We'll get back to it later when we learn a little bit more. Okay. So Rabbi Yitzchak's question is, why did this Torah have to start with Machodesh Hazeh? Why couldn't the Torah have started with Machodesh Hazeh? Why does it need to do all of Bereshis? Which, of course, you read that question, your immediate reaction is, what? Hello, Sefer Bereshit. Okay, so it's got some of the best stories, but even putting that aside, Akedas Yitzchak's in there. Brit Ben Habitarim is in there. What happens in Gan Eden is there. I sort of can't imagine the Torah without it. What exactly is Rabbi Yitzchak asking? The question gets enforced when we look at a Gemara in source number 5, a Gemara in Sanhedrin. If you'll read along with me. Tanu Rabbanan, our rabbis learn in a Braisa. Hanefesh asher taseh biyad ramah. A person who shall act high-handedly. Ze Menashe ben Chizkia. This refers to King Menashe, the son of King Chizkia. They ruled in the last eighth of Malchut Yehuda. Shehaya Yoshev v'doresh b'hagadot shel dofi, who used to sit and learn and make fun of the Torah. Amar. And what would Menashe say that made fun of the Torah? V'chilo haya l'moshe l'chtov ela v'achot lo tantimna. What the heck did Moshe have to write the pasuk in Bereishis Perek Lamed Vav that Lotan's sister was Timna? Bereishis Perek Lamed Vav, which is the chapter right before the Joseph narratives, is a list of Esav's descendants. It tells us his genealogy and his family tree. And in terms of the entire structure of Sefer Bereishis, it fits. Because we have genealogies in the form of tables and lists for all of the rejected children. Noach has a family tree with very few stories. Yishmael has a family tree with no stories. Esav has a family tree with no stories. They're out. Ela Toldot Yitzchak's story, Ela Toldot Yaakov's story, they're the ones that are in. So Perek Lamed Vav appears right before the Joseph narratives to sort of say Esav was out, now let's learn the story of Yaakov who's in. In that genealogical list, one of the psukim says that Lotan's sister was Timna. And Menashe, who's reading the parak, is like, who needs that stupid detail? So he's making fun of the Torah. V'timna haita pilegesh l'Eliphaz. I mean, who is Timna? She was a concubine for Eliphaz, Esav's son. Like, who cares about her? V'yelech Reuben b'mei k'tir chitim v'imsad dudim b'sadeh. And who cares about that pasuk in chapter 30 of Bereishi? That said, then Reuven went out during the harvest to find mandrakes. Like, who cares? Yatz'ah bat kol v'amra, when he was sitting there in the Beit Midrash making fun of all these psukim, a voice came out and said, Tashev v'achicha tidaber v'ben imecha, titein dofi ela asita v'hecharashti, demita heyot eyek hamocha, ochichecha v'ercha leinecha. It's a pasuk in Tehillim. You're sitting there, the pasuk says, and you're doing dofi, you're making fun? You should be quiet, Echarashta. You should shut up. Ochichecha, I'm coming to reprove you. I'm coming to clarify what you said because you made fun. Skip down two lines. In the middle of the line, the Gemara then addresses why that pasuk needed to be there. It says, Mihat achon lotan timna maihi. So why is that pasuk there? Timna bat malachim havi. Because Timna was royalty. Dichtiv aluf lotan aluf timna. Because in that same parak, we see that timna is listed as an aluf. V'chol aluf malchuta below tagahi. Okay? And the Gemara says that aluf implies that it was a royal line. Ba'ali gori, bata etzel Avram Yitzchak Yaakov lo kibluha. She was royalty, and she went to Avram, to Yitzchak and to Yaakov, to try to marry them. Halcha v'haita pilegesh le'lifaz ben Esav. So she went and became a concubine to Esav's son Eliphaz. Amra, what did she say? Mutav teheshivcha l'umazu. Better I should be a maidservant to this nation, v'lo teheg vira l'umacheret, rather than be a princess to another nation. Okay, so basically the Gemara is teaching us that Menashe, who was evil, he ruled for 55 years. According to Sefer Malachim, written by Yirmiyahu, it's his fault that the Beis HaMikdash got destroyed. Basically, he put a pesel, an idol, in the Beit HaMikdash itself. Gets a big yikes. And for 55 years, he put Avodah Zarah everywhere in the country. And even though he did Shuvah at the end, it was insufficient. He could not undo the damage of his reign. And even though he did Shuvah, he couldn't get the other people to do Shuvah sufficiently. He couldn't wipe it out. And the Navi says in Malachim, because of you, Menashe, I'm bringing the Beit HaMikdash. It's a gzerah. And nothing else you can do can undo it. So that's who Menashe is. So it's sort of not shocking that he's making fun of the Torah. I guess this was pre-Tshuva, obviously. But in any event, the reason why I'm bringing you this Gemara is because the Torah beliefs, Achot Lotan Timna Fiers, are so important. Even those three words about some concubine married to Esav's son is significant and belongs in the Torah. If that's the view of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, then we really need to ask, what is Rabbi Yitzchak talking about? What do you mean you don't need Bereishis? If everything, Achot Lotan Timna is in Bereishis, what is he talking about? So too, The Ramban, who quotes this Rashi, asks a similar question. If you look with me in source 6 where I underlined. The Yishlish Olba, he quotes Rashi, he says, let's ask. There is a huge need to begin the Torah from Bereshis. Ki hu shoresh ha'emuna. It's the source of faith. V'she'eino ma'amin bazeh, v'choshev sha'olam kadmon, hu kofer be'ikar v'en lo Torah kal. Anyone who doesn't realize that God created the world and chas v'shalom thinks that the world came first is an apikoros, is somebody who denies the fundamental truth and doesn't belong in a Torah Jew community. What are you talking about? What is Rabbi Yitzchak talking about? So that's the first question that I'd like to ask. The Gur Aryeh, a super commentary on Rashi, has an answer that I'd like to share with you. For those of us who are new to the term, I don't know what anybody knows, so here goes. A super commentary is a commentary that explains a commentary, meaning they don't comment on the verses, they read through a commentary's perush, and they make it more clear to us. So, for example, Rashi, shocking, has the most super commentaries. And very often, if you don't understand something in Rashi, you open up one of the super commentaries and they explain it to us. One of the more famous ones is the Maharal from Prague, who wrote the Gur Aryeh. And his answer is that Rabbi Yitzchak wasn't suggesting that it doesn't belong anywhere, just that it didn't belong here in the Torah. If you're familiar possibly with the Gemara in Baba Basra that lists what the Chaftal of Sifrei Tanakh are, the 24 books of the Torah, and their authors, one of the lists in the author, it says, Moshe Katav Sifro, Parshat Bilam, the Eov. Moshe wrote his book, the story of Bilam, and Eov. Just like Eov was written by Moshe and didn't make it into Torah, so the Gur Aryeh says maybe what Rabbi Yitzchak meant was, not that it's not important, but does it need to be in the Torah itself? Couldn't it be in another book that we just have somewhere? So he tries to mitigate what Rabbi Yitzchak's question is. Not that it's not important, does it need to be in the Torah itself? The Ramban has a different answer. Basically, you know what, one second, we'll get to the Ramban in a minute. So basically, the Gur Aryeh tries to make sense of the fact that he's not saying it's not important or that it should be excluded, just excluded from the Torah. Okay, so the next question is, what's so special about Me'achodesh Hazeh Lachem? Okay, so Rashi says, Shehi mitzvah harishana shenitztavu b'Yisrael. It's the first mitzvah that B'nai Yisrael were commanded. No, it's not. Zayin mitzvah B'nai Noach? Noachite commandments? Brit Milah? Gid HaNasheh, the thingy in Yaakov's thigh? It's not. What's going on? So a careful reading of Rashi tells us that he's not saying the first mitzvah. It's the first mitzvah shenitztavu ba Yisrael. The nation was commanded. All the other mitzvahs that I talked about were given to yichidim, to individuals. They weren't given to the nation. And when Moshe gave the Torah, he regave those so that everybody would know that they were in fact part of the Torah. And that until Moshe did that, they weren't part of Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe until Moshe actually commanded it. So what's significant about that is that if you look at source number 3, the Yalkut Shimoni, do you see those lines over there? Shehi mitzvah rishona shenitztavu b'Yisrael after the words Me'achodesh Hazeh Lachem? No. Okay? That's a Rashi addition. As we may know, Rashi, for the most part, didn't originate his answers. What he did was go through all the Midrashim and bring the answer that was the most pshat. So what Rashi did was bring the Midrash that he thought was the most pshat, but he didn't just quote it. He worked with it, and he helped clarify it for us, and he helped it make sense. So by a comparison to the Tanchuma as quoted by the Yalkut Shimoni, we see that Rashi added those words to clarify to us that HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem, what's so special about it? That it's the first mitzvah that B'nai Yisrael were commanded as a people, as we saw when we looked at the Psukim in Shmos in source number 1. Yehuda Nachshoni, in his studies on this Rashi, suggests that when Rashi added the words Shenitztavu ba Yisrael, that Israel was commanded, that what Rashi was trying to say to us was that Rabbi Yitzchak, in order to understand his words, wasn't just saying this mitzvah, that the Torah should have started with this mitzvah, but it should have started with the whole unit that made us a nation, i.e. Yetziat Mitzrayim. In other words, when you read the Rashi, according to Yehuda Nachshoni, what he's suggesting is, when you read the words in source number 2, first line, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, lo haya tzarich latchil at Torah, ela ma'achor shezeh lechem, shehi mitzvah rishona shenitzavu ba'Yisrael, what he means is, why not start the Torah from Yetziat Mitzrayim? If the Torah, which comes from the word hora'ah, instruction, is instruction of laws for the people, then why not start with the story that made us a people? Why do we need to start with the whole stories of Bereshit, which has universalistic aspects to it? Why not start where it made us a nation, and thus the mitzvah that we get the first time as a nation? Now, what's interesting about that answer is that you could argue that the reason why Rabbi Yitzchak's question could make sense that way is because on a certain level, the entire story of Yetziat Mitzrayim includes creation within it. The way that it includes creation is that before every set of makot, there's an educational objective that was given to them. B'zot teda ki ani Hashem, b'zot teda ki ani Hashem b'kerev ha'aretz, b'zot teda ki ein kamoni, you should know I'm Hashem, you should know I'm Hashem in the midst of the land, you should know that there's nobody else like me. Sounds like creation kind of stuff. So before every set of 3 plagues, there was a clear educational motive and objective stated for that set of plagues. So you could argue that Yetziat Mitzrayim actually contains the messages of Yetziat of Briat HaOlam, because it has the educational objectives that Briat HaOlam is supposed to teach us. And the truth of the matter is that Yetziat Mitzrayim and the plagues and creation are similar. They're both very organized. The structure of chapter 1 of Bereshit and chapter 7 to 11 in Shmos are very organized, and their structure is parallel. We have 3-3-3-1 in the days of creation, and 3-3-1 by the Makot, right? 3 sets of plagues, 3 sets of plagues, 3 sets of plagues, then Bechorot. So even so, it contains creation. So maybe what Rabbi Yitzchak is asking is, if Yetziat Mitzrayim is what made us a nation, and if HaChodesh HaZeh Lechem is the first mitzvah we got as a nation, why not start the book of instruction of the laws to the nation over there? And if you want to say, well, some of the Bereshit stuff is so important in terms of Emunah, like the Rambam said, that doesn't have to be a worry for us because it's included in Yetziat Mitzrayim. So before we continue, let's sum up what we did. We're trying to very closely study the first Rashi in the Torah. The first thing we talked about, the author, Rabbi Yitzchak, I'm suggesting it's not his father, and I have yet to explain why I think he quoted him by name. The next thing we tried to understand is, why would you get rid of Bereshit? We amplified the question by quoting the Ramban and quoting the Gemara in Sanhedrin. And now we started to answer how the question isn't as awful as it sounds, with the Gur Aryeh's answer, who said it's not that it should be excluded entirely, just in a different book. And that it's not that we're not saying the Bereshit doesn't have value, says Nachshoni, but that it's sort of included in Yetziat Mitzrayim, and since it's a book of a nation, why include parts that are universalistic? So with that in mind, let's continue with the Rashi and see what Rabbi Yitzchak gave as his answer. Umatam patach b'Bereishit. So why did we start with Bereishit? Mishum, because koach masav yigid lamo latet lehem nachlak oyim. Because the power of his deeds, Hashem wanted to tell his people in order to give them the inheritance of the nations. Because if the goyim comes to say, it's our land, you stole it, we'll say, no, it's Hashem's land, he can give it to anybody who wants. Okay, I don't think I need to explicate why that's sort of a weird answer. How exactly does that explain anything to us at all? First of all, you only needed one chapter then. The first chapter tells us God created it. So how does that answer explain why we need all the rest? Also, yeah, that's going to work. The other possible title that I was considering was, would the UN like Rashi's answer? Somehow I'm thinking not. So what exactly is this all talking about? So if we look back at the Ramban that we were looking at before, he'll help us understand Rashi's answer. In this case, this paragraph of the Ramban, he's acting like a super commentary because he's helping us make Rashi make more sense. So if you look at the last paragraph in source number 6, I underlined it. V'natan Rabbi Yitzchak tam lazeh, and Rabbi Yitzchak gave a reason for this. Everyone have it? Source 6, page 2, fourth line from the bottom, it's underlined. Ki yitchila ha-Torah bebreishit bara Elokim, v'sipur kol inyan ha-yitzira ad briyat ha-adam, v'shimshilu b'masei adav v'chol shat tachar raglav, v'gan eden shehu mivchar mekamot ha-nivriim ba'olam hazeh, na'aseh machon l'shivto, ad shegiresh oto chet omisham, v'anshei dor ha-mabol b'chetam gorshu min ha-olam kulo, v'hatzadik behem levado nimlat hu banav, v'zaram chatam garam lehem lahafitzam v'mekomol lezartam ratzot, v'tafsu lehem mekomol lemishmachotem v'goyim kifishin is the main lehem. The reason why is because Hashem told the whole story of creation, starting with the creation of man, and how God gave him all this power and put him in the choicest place of the world, Gan Eden, where God himself chose to dwell, until his sin caused him to get kicked out. And then the generation of the flood, because of their sin, all had to be expelled from the world completely until one righteous man was left with his family. And then their descendants sinned with the building of the ziggurat in Babel until they had to be scattered everywhere. And they scattered throughout the world. The Ramban continues on page 3 on the top. In came Ra'uihu, therefore it is fitting that, Kasher Yosif Hagoy Lachto, as the nation continues to sin, Sheyovan Mimkomo, Vayavoy Goyachad, La Reshat Tatarso, that the principle is established that when you sin, you are exiled and another nation comes to take your place. Kichenu Mishpat Elokim Be'eretz Me'olam, and that is how God has run the land since the beginning. All the more so that Canaan was cursed and was sold as an Eved forever to shame, and it's not fitting that he'll inherit forever. Rather, God's servants, a.k.a. us, will inherit it. Kinyan Shekatuv, like we have the Pasuk said, V'yitain lahem artzot goyim, that God is going to give us the lands of the nation. Klomar, second to last line in the middle, Shegiresh Misham Ordav, God's going to kick out the rebellers, V'hishkin bo avadav, and he's going to help settle in it his servants, Sheyed'u ki ba'avodato yinchaluha, that in service of God they will inherit it, V'im yachte'u lo, but if they sin, Takiyo Tamar, you get kicked out too. Kasher Ka'at Agoy Sherlefim, just like God kicked out the nation before you. So what the Ramban says is that the reason why Rabbi Yitzchak says that you need all of Bereishit so that Hashem can show all his deeds, it's not just the last line, that Hashem created the world and therefore he can give it to who he wants. but that all the stories included in the entire Sefer demonstrate the concept of Schar V'Onesh, Chet V'Onesh, and Galut. Basically that, if you sin, you're out, and someone else gets it. When they sin, they're out, and then somebody else gets it. When they sin, they're out, and somebody else gets it. And that Sefer Bereishit, the Ramban explains Rabbi Yitzchak's comment for us, helps us understand, the whole Sefer helps us understand the idea that not only did God create the world, and he can give it to whoever he wants, but he set forth a concept and principle that he abides by, that even applies to us, hi, we're here. If you don't follow the rules, if you don't do the avodah of Hashem, you're out. And what's important for us to understand is, would the UN accept this answer? No. I don't think they'd accept any answers, but that's time for another lecture and way too depressing to start a Sunday morning with. Koach masav higid lamo. Who is this for? It's not for them. The Pasuk in Tehillim says it's for us. Rabbi Block Zatzal from the Tel Shishiva would say about this particular Rashi that the point of this Rashi is for us to know that we should never feel guilty, that before we even work with anybody, we need to realize that God created the world and he gives it to those who are worthy, and when we got it, we're worthy and it's ours. And that this Rashi isn't about what we say to the Goyim, it's what we say to ourselves. Are we ever really going to be able to convince them? No. It's about what we need to understand about Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, what's interesting about that is that's where we come to understanding who Rabbi Yitzchak is. If everybody could look with me in source number 10, according to Rabbi Heinemann Zatzal, who wrote a book on the Tanaim and the Moraim, any time in the Gemara that it's Stam, just mentions a Rabbi Yitzchak and doesn't give any information, it's Rabbi Yitzchak ben Nafcha. It's possible that the Rabbi Yitzchak in the Tanchuma is the same Rabbi Yitzchak, in which case we have the great opportunity to not only know the Rabbi Yitzchak from the Tanchuma, but to see another comment of his from another place that might shed light on him in terms of a tonal perspective. So let's see what Rabbi Yitzchak says in the Gemara in Brachos 7b. Hamar Rabbi Yitzchak, it's in the middle of a discussion about whether you're allowed to start up with nations. Are you allowed to start up with the Goyim? If you see a Rasha and the time is being playing with him, being nice to him, al titzgarebo, don't start up with him. Shne'emar yachilu drachav b'chaleit, that everything he does will be successful. V'lo od el shezocheh b'din, not only that, but justice will look askance at what he does and not pay him back till much later. Shne'emar marom mishpatecha minegdo, that the judgment from on high is away from him. V'lo od el shero'eh b'tzarav, and not only that, but he'll see his enemies fall. Shne'emar kol tzarav yafiach b'hem, that all of his enemies will be thrown apart by a wind like they're a straw. So Rabbi Yitzchak seems to be the person who says, you shouldn't start up with Goyim. In which case, how weird is it that Rabbi Yitzchak is the one who's quoted as saying, if the Goyim say, this is what you should say. How do we understand what's going on? So the rest of the Gemara explains to us that all Rabbi Yitzchak was saying was not that you shouldn't start up with Goyim, but that you shouldn't start up with them about personal matters, but about matters that are heavenly, like who owns Israel, then it's okay. And therefore, maybe the reason why Rashi was quoting Rabbi Yitzchak in the middle was because this idea of dealing with the Goyim is to show us that Rabbi Yitzchak is the one who says, yeah, for personal stuff, don't, but for something like this, you should. So before we continue, let's go back to the Rashi in source number 2, and let's clear out what we've covered so far and what we have left to do. We identified Rabbi Yitzchak, and we just explained that he's not Rashi's father. He could possibly be Rabbi Yitzchak Nafcha from the Gemara in Brachot, and he's the one who says you can start up with Goyim when It's not personal matters. We said, why would Rabbi Yitzchak suggest that you not need Sefer Bereishit, either because it just should be in a different book, or because Yitziat Mitzrayim includes the concepts anyway. We pointed out Shenitzavu BaYisrael is what gives us the idea that it's talking about Yitziat Mitzrayim, and that's Rashi's own inclusion. And now we're discussing his answer that Hashem wanted to teach us Sefer Bereishis so that A, we would know what was going on, and B, as the Ramban unpacks for us, so that we understand the whole concept of if you get kicked out if you don't do something wrong. The last thing that I'd like to analyze with you is where this whole idea comes that the Goyim are going to call us thieves. Right? How relevant is this to us today? Why are they going to call us thieves? I am not experienced, trained, or educated enough to discuss the socio-political or geographic explanations to that answer. I will try to answer them from a Torah biblical point of view of Rashi. Okay, so why are they going to call us thieves? So according to the Chassam Sofer, who has a very interesting answer, the Chassam Sofer says that the Goyim are under this mistaken belief that we can only inherit things miraculously. Also, such a relevant machloket for today. Just like Yetziat Mitzrayim was miraculous, just like Yericho when we conquered the land was miraculous, there are a lot of miraculous things that always accompany our successes, and the Goyim, who are going to see us conquering it naturally, are going to call us thieves. And they're going to say, according to the Chassam Sofer, you had no right to take it. If God had wanted to give it to you, he would have done a miracle for you. You're thieves. You're taking it when it's not yours. That's the Chassam Sofer's answer. The Lubavitcher Rebbe has a different answer. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, for those of you who don't know, used to put out a sicha every week for years on Rashi. And they recently, in the last 5 to 10 years, recently published a 5-volume set, Likutei Sichot al HaTorah. They don't have all of them, but they have a lot of his sichot republished. There were these little pamphlets that he'd send out where he did close readings of Rashi's, much like what we're doing today. And he wrote a book called Klalei Rashi, Principles of Rashi, and therefore it's very common when studying Rashi to see what the Lubavitcher Rebbe has to say. He was very learned and sophisticated in his understanding and application of how Rashi worked. The Lubavitcher Rebbe's answer about why the Goyim would call us thieves is a beautiful answer. An answer that fits with the whole idea in the Rashi, that the whole message to us is for us to know. And that's the idea that what the Goyim are claiming, that we're thieves, is because when we conquered the land, it then became Eretz Yisrael. Until then, it had been known as Eretz Canaan. But when we conquered it, it then became Eretz Yisrael and could only belong to Am Yisrael. And therefore, the Gentiles claim that we stole the land because we basically took it away from the rest of the nations of the world forever. And we can see this idea of the Lubavitcher Rebbe in a few different places. One place we can see it is in the Torah, in source number 14, Devarim chapter 30. V'hayak yavo alecha kol advrim ha'ela habracha v'aklal asher natati lefanecha v'hashevota el avavcha b'chol goyim asher hidichecha Hashem olkecha shama v'shavta ad Hashem olkecha v'shamata b'kolo kechol asher nochi mitzavcha yom ata uvanecha b'chol avavcha b'chol nafshecha v'shav Hashem olkecha et shvutcha v'richamecha v'shav v'kibetzcha mikol amim asher hefitcha Hashem olkecha shama im yeni dedechecha b'kse ha'shmaim misham yikabetzcha Hashem olkecha u'misham yikachecha v'havyelcha Hashem olkecha el ha'aretz asher yarshu avotecha v'yirashta v'hitifcha. It's talking about mass tshuva. It's talking about the fact that even this perek follows right after the klalos, the curses in the Torah. Right after the curses, which tells you all the horrible things that are going to happen to you if you don't keep the rules. And one of them is galut, and horrible, disgusting things are going to happen to you as an onesh, as a punishment for not following the Torah. The next chapter immediately says, there's always the option of tshuva. There's always the option of tshuva, and what tshuva does is bring us back. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe's idea can be seen in these psukim, which is the idea that even when we get kicked out, there's still a promise that if we do tshuva, we can go back. Something to take to heart. Another way that we can see the Lubavitcher Rebbe's idea is from our davening. Galinu me'artzenu, v'nitrachaknu mi'al admatenu. We were exiled from our land. We are far away from our earth. Even when we are in Galut, we call it our land. We can also see it in a matter of halacha. If you turn to page 4, source number 15. Kol shehechziku ole Mitzrayim v'nitzkadesh k'dusha rishona, kevan shegalu bitlu k'dushatan. Those who came out of Egypt and entered Israel made it kadosh, but the minute they were exiled, the kedusha ended. Shekedusha rishona lafi shaita mipnei hakivush bilvad, kadsha l'shata v'lo kadsha latid lavo. That since this first kedusha they did when they entered the land was only through their conquering, it was only a temporary kedusha. Kevan she'alu b'nei ha'gola v'hechziku b'miktzat ha'aretz kitshua kedusha shnia ha'omedet la'olam. But when the second group came after that first galut and came back to the land, they only conquered a little part of it, but they sanctified it, and it's a sanctity that lasts forever. V'hinichu otam ha'mekamot she'hechziku b'hem olei Mitzrayim v'lo hechziku b'hem olei Bavel k'shayu v'lo pitra mina turma v'masrot k'dei she'yismuchu aleim aniyim b'shvit. Okay? And basically what we see is that there are some areas that they didn't hold on to and there are other areas that they did, but they weren't putter from trumos and maestros. And basically what this halacha from the Rambam shows us is that when Ezra and Nehemiah came back during Shivat Zion period, the Kedusha that we got lasted forever and that it belongs to us. So the Lubavitcher Rebbe's idea is a beautiful one, that why are they going to call us thieves? Because we stole it away from everybody forever. So to sum up where we've been in terms of the Rashi, we've identified the author and suggested the hypothesis why Rashi might have quoted him by name. We tried to understand Rabbi Yitzchak's question. We tried to notice the way Rashi manipulated the Midrash and worked with it to make it clearer to us. We tried to understand his answer with the help of the Ramban. And then we analyzed what the Gentile nations are going to say to understand from them why they might say it, as well as why the answer really isn't for them, but really for us. And there's one last thing I'd like to end with that really flows with the Lubavitcher Rebbe's idea. That the land, even when we're in Galut, is still ours. And look with me at a midrash from Devarim Rabbah in source number 16. Amar Rabbi Levi, Amar lefanav Ribono shel Olam, Atzmotav shel Yosef nechnechsu l'aretz, ba'ani eini nechnas l'aretz. Moshe and God had a conversation. Moshe said to Hashem, the bones of Yosef are getting to go into Israel, and I can't enter? Amar lo HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God said to Moshe, Mi shehoda ba'artzo, nikbar ba'artzo. Mi shelo hoda ba'artzo, eino nikbar ba'artzo. He who acknowledges his land gets buried there. He who doesn't get buried there. Yosef hoda ba'artzo minayin. Where do we see that Yosef acknowledged his land? Gvirato Omer, his boss, Eshet Potiphar, said, Re'u hevilanu ishivri. She said to her servants when she was getting Yosef in trouble, look, they brought an Hebrew man to us. V'lo kafarin, we didn't stop her. Ella, rather, he himself said in jail to Sarah Mashkim, Gnov gunavti me'eretz ha'ivrim, I was kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews. He acknowledged, Nikbar ba'artzo. He was buried in his land. Shene emar, because the pasuk says, Ve'et atzmot Yosef asher he'alum eretz Yisrael kavru b'shchem. The bones of Yosef that they took out of Egypt, they buried in Shchem. At shelo hodzat ha'baretz, but you, Moshe, who didn't acknowledge your land, Ein atar nikbar ba'artzecha. You're not going to be buried in the land. Ketzad, where do we see that about Moshe? I mean, my goodness, in Sefer Devarim, after Hashem told him that he can't go in, it is heart-wrenching and tragic to see him begging over and over and over again to go in. What are we talking about? Benot Yitro omrot ish mitzri hisilano miyad horim. The daughters of Yitro said to him, an Egyptian man saved us, who shomea v'shotek. He heard them call him an Egyptian, and he didn't clarify. L'fichach lo nikbar b'artzo, and therefore he wasn't buried in his land. Obviously, this is very hard to deal with, and it's not the only reason why Moshe wasn't going to be buried in the land. It just gives us a perspective on the fact that on his level, he should never have let it be confused who he was. The message I think that we can take out of this, as we learn the first Rosh in the Torah, which talks about the maftir of this coming Shabbos, is that this is for us to know that Hashem created the world, He chooses who it goes to, He teaches us that your chait gets you kicked out. We learn that if you do tshuva, you can always go back. It's ours forever. And as long as we always acknowledge that it's our land and always see our connection to it like Yosef did, Emir Tashem, one day we should get back very, very soon. B'mehera b'yameinu. If you have any questions, please feel free to come up and ask. Okay, so let me just explain tetratah. I was just trying to be whatever. So pentatah is five, so tetra is four. So is Rashi advocating that you don't need the first book of the Torah? That's where the title comes from.